Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angi.com.
Be a part of the best pro wrestling podcast today by supporting the Going In Raw Patreon. You can enjoy access to the live taping of the show, exclusive merchandise, and patron-only episodes, and so much more. Support Going In Raw today. Click the link in the description.
This is the glorious one, Bobby Roode, and you're watching Going In Raw.
Hey, Brendo, Steve here.
Ed Larson.
Hey, welcome to Going In Raw. View, kind of. We're doing a review today of the Ric Flair 30 for 30 that ESPN produced.
Nature Boy.
The Nature Boy that aired this past Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah, following SmackDown.
Following SmackDown, live, exactly. Fascinating. In terms of, like, factually, chronologically, things that happened in his past, nothing we hadn't really heard before.
No, I think the WWE-produced documentary on Ric Flair covered a lot of the same ground. I mean, they didn't go into some of the aspects of his personal life that were dealt with in this film. Obviously, any sort of salacious content was maybe subtly alluded to in WWE's production, whereas in this, they dealt with it a bit more head-on.
A tad more head-on. I mean, there was the big quote that came out of this was he gave his number of women slept with over the years at 10,000, which is a pretty big number.
That's a very large number.
Very large number. And when he said that, I didn't think about it, I wasn't like, wait a second. Was there a period when he wasn't married? And I looked it up, and I was like, no. He was married the entire time. I was like, oh, my God. Because I don't remember who had, like, 20,000. Was it Wilt? Wilt Chamberlain?
Yeah, maybe.
Was it him?
It was him. I mean, he said he slept with a lot of women.
Somebody said 20,000.
So has Lemmy from Motorhead. Apparently, he was, like, 8,000. And then
but
Gene Simmons.
I don't remember. I don't remember if Wilt Chamberlain. I mean, who has the 20,000 number mark? I think, and that's like, you know, the gold standard. I say that tongue in cheek. By the way,
400 women a year for 50 years.
Yeah,
my math is right.
But I don't remember if Wilt was married or not.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, you know, we're both married. I take that very seriously.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, but anyways, it was in that regard to you know, because you're on ESPN and not. The WWE productions, I don't really want to call them fluff pieces because they go in depth sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
But when you're ESPN, you know, those 30 for 30s have production value and they really do try to hit at the truth in a lot of, you know, they like to really go in depth into their subject. They are fantastic.
Yeah, the 30 for 30 series, pretty much across the board, the ones that I've seen, have all been really good or fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. And so Ric Flair is obviously, in my book, probably the greatest pro wrestler of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know a lot before, you know, from the 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s.
Yeah. You haven't seen a whole lot of Orville Brown matches, what you're saying. I understand
right,
that.
Exactly.
But definitely since...
And I'm talking about America as well.
Yeah, the era of wrestling that we've been exposed to,
yeah, sure.
We've been alive pretty much. Yeah, Ric Flair is probably topping that.
Because you look at his in-ring performances and you look at his promo skills, obviously. You look at all the ingredients that we appreciate in a professional wrestler and Ric Flair.
Not to mention his longevity, being able to do that for such a sustained period.
Right, exactly.
Or, I mean, he won his first championship in 81.
Mm-hmm.
And for at least a decade, I would say that decade between that first win and when he left the WWF,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he was the top guy in NWA.
Yeah.
Untouched.
Yeah,
I mean,
he
dropped the belt off and off, but he was pretty much that whole time the top guy.
One of the things that was illustrated in this documentary that was hammered home, and it was really hammered home by none other than Hulk Hogan, was how selfless Ric Flair was in terms of his selling and putting people over.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen Hogan display as much humility.
Yes.
As he has.
Yes.
As he did in this film.
He said Ric Flair was 10 times the wrestler he was. And he said Ric Flair, he was like, Ric Flair had no problems losing, he said, and making me look much better than I actually was. I think he referred to himself as having limited, I think he said the words limited ability.
Yeah, he did. He said, I have plan A, B, C, and D.
Right.
He had four ways he could approach a match.
Right,
just tell me which one to do.
Yeah, yeah. Which is crazy to hear Hulk Hogan talk about himself like that. I mean, he has to have some self-awareness these days. He understands, hey, look, his legacy is cemented. You know, I mean, recent, you know, issues aside, his legacy can even withstand that, you know, mostly. But the most fascinating theme throughout this was the dual identity of Ric Flair, real name Richard Fleer.
Yes.
He was adopted, I believe, if I got the math right, within a month of him being born. And he was told about his adoption around the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
But as he got older, he became kind of a troublemaker.
Yeah.
He healed up in real life.
Kind of, yeah. He got sent to a boarding school in his teens, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it was on the eve of Father's Day. His dad had to come down to the jailhouse.
He was trying to buy alcohol with a fake ID.
Right, yeah. You never hear about people getting caught and like what the consequences are for that. You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Apparently you go down to the jailhouse. But his dad had to get him out of that. One thing that especially permeates the entire show for me was something that Triple H said later on.
Yeah, I think there's two quotes from different people that we really both
hung
on to. Yeah.
Triple H said, one thing you have to understand about Rick is that he's a consummate liar. And so when Rick talks about his parents, because we talked about this off camera a little bit prior to us even starting the day, really, in that you have to wonder how his relationship with his family, with his parents, affected him growing up. And it seemed, you know, he would talk about them saying, you know, they only ever went to one of my matches.
Yeah, they went to three of his professional matches.
Right, yeah, three of them. They weren't into this, that, and the other thing. I would have loved to, and obviously I really doubt they're alive at this point. It would be interesting to know their take on that. Because if you have a kid who's, you know, sometimes kids are just beyond reach at a certain point. You know, you reach out and you reach out. And, I mean, I've heard this from my mom talking about her friends, that sometimes, you know, there's a parent can only do so much
mm-hmm.
before your kid is just out of reach. So I don't know if his situation was such that his bridges were burned because of that, because of adoption issues, which we talked about prior to this as well.
We
both know people who've been adopted.
Yeah.
And there's no issues there beyond.
It's
just a fact of my
life. I think a lot of that too depends on the family situation.
Right. Exactly.
Family which you're adopted.
Yeah.
Because when I first watched it, I didn't watch the whole thing. I stopped. With about 15 minutes left, right before they were going to go to the talk about Reed.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And up to that point, the quote that stuck with me was Shawn Michaels saying, I'll paraphrase, that Ric Flair didn't much like Richard Fleer.
Yes.
But the problem was that Ric Flair was a myth.
Yeah.
He was a creation.
Yeah.
And so, in the end of the day, and there's countless times where Flair talks about, and other people talk about, when he wasn't on the road and when he wasn't performing, when he wasn't hanging out with the guys, when he was home, he was miserable. Probably because he had to face the fact that he was not just Ric Flair, he was Richard Fleer as well.
Yeah.
And part of me kind of wondered, and this is speculation, because I like to delve into psychological
stuff. Yeah, of course, yeah, it's fascinating.
Why people behave the way
people
they
are interesting.
They really are. As you mentioned, the adoption aspect of it, like, because he kind of blows off learning that he was adopted.
Mm, yeah.
Not a huge deal. Yeah. He kind of said, yeah, they told me when I was a 10, I didn't really think much of it. But to, and even just on a subconscious level, to think, okay, I'm adopted, so in a sense, my birth parents rejected me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, growing up, my parents, as he tells it, this is all through his the prism of Ric Flair,
mm-hmm.
My adoptive parents, in a sense, because they weren't, didn't seem invested, because he talked about how they were out of town all the time,
yeah,
never went to, or rarely went to his sporting events, rarely seemed interested in what he was interested in himself, that perhaps he felt, in a sense, rejected
mm-hmm.
by his adoptive parents as well, and he found solace in this creation that he made,
yeah.
where he didn't have to be Richard Fleer. He could be Ric Flair. He can be, you know, limousine riding, kiss stealing.
Jet flying. I still don't know the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is absolutely fascinating. My point, my counter to that was, I mean, my thing is this. Number one, the Triple H statement of he's a consummate liar makes me think. And here's the thing, like Rick, he never, you know, there are plenty of things in the documentary he opened up about that. You know, he doesn't look great, you know, and he was fine opening up about it. He even said there was a quote, I forget what the quote is, but it was something along the lines of, you know, I'm never going to be known as the best father. I'm never going to be known as the best husband. I know I wasn't those things, but I might be able to be known as the best professional
wrestler.
Well,
I think right there that statement is kind of the dichotomy of Richard Fleer and Ric Flair.
Right.
Because despite knowing that he'll never be known as the best father or husband, it's like he takes some solace in knowing
mm-hmm.
that he still was Ric Flair.
Yeah. But I just thought, I was like, you know, if the dude, you know, if he could get away with everything
yeah.
he was getting away with, I just think, I mean, you know, not to reach too much, but, you know, we're seeing these days, especially in the last couple of months, when men especially, have power to do something and they can get away with it.
They push the boundaries even more, yeah.
You know. And so, absolutely fascinating case study. There's a couple other sort of like almost devastating, I mean, beyond the Reed Flair stuff, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
But there was one statement that his first daughter mentioned, and she said, you know, I got a lot of stuff from him. I just didn't get a lot of time with him. He would bring home dozens of Cabbage Patch kids for me.
Cabbage Patch dolls. Yeah.
Right. But I never saw him. He
yeah.
never came to my games or anything. And it's like, I don't think that Ric Flair didn't love his kids. He obviously does.
Well, his first wife said that he was mm-hmm. not a good husband, but he was always
mm-hmm.
a loving father.
Yeah. He just wasn't there.
Yeah, just wasn't there ever.
And, you know, the sad thing is, it's like, you know, he talks about, well, you know, when you're the world champion, you have to be blah, blah, blah. But then he talks about, you know, when he's home, his first wife was talking about, yeah, well, you know, he'd be home and he'd say, I can't be here. I'm so bored. And he'd go a couple miles down the road to where his eventual second wife was hanging out with
Greg Valentine's house.
Greg Valentine's house,
the
exactly.
The Hammer.
Yeah, the Hammer, exactly. And so, I mean, I think what's kind of odd to me, though, is that he ever was married in the first place.
Yeah, that's an interesting move on his part.
You know, because he kept on. He leapt from one to the next.
Also, he's asked by the director, you know, why do you think you can't be monogamous?
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, just wasn't for me. He said he tried hard for one day.
Yeah.
While he was married.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you can't stop from sleeping with 10,000 women,
yeah,
then just don't get married.
I would have figured after the first wife, it would just be like, okay, well, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting, and it kind of my only qualm with the production in general was that, I mean, you know, rightfully so. If I was interviewing Ric Flair, I'd probably be genuflecting too. I'd probably be like, oh my god, this is great, this is amazing. I feel like the director might have like prodded a little bit more of that, because it's like, why are you even bothering the family? Like, why are you doing this in the first place? I mean, maybe it's just that's what you do. You get married, you have kids, and,
yeah.
you know. But
I mean, it could be the push and pull within him between
yeah.
Richard Fleer and Ric Flair. There would be sometimes where his life, he might have thought, okay, I'm going to try this. I think I can do it now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but it's fascinating though, because he, you know, you look up his Wikipedia and his marriages, and it's just, you know, it's just one to the next to the next.
We've been around five times.
The same year that he gets divorced is the same year he gets married. So we just hop from one to the next to the next. They interviewed all sorts of people. Undertaker was interviewed.
Out of character.
That was weird.
Yeah.
Because his voice.
Did you see what the director put on Twitter?
Yeah.
The nicest person he's ever interviewed. He had snacks and coffee,
made coffee
ready for the crew.
Yeah. Yeah. His voice tripped me out because it was so much more soft and high-pitched.
Yeah.
I'm used to this.
Yeah.
Even in the WWE documentaries, he talks like this. And then the thing, he talks more like this. Ric Flair's a good guy. He talks like Grizzly almost.
I wouldn't go that
Not
far.
Not that far. Oh, man. One interesting quote that I pulled from it, too. We're getting, I mean, this is kind of all over the map.
Yeah.
But when they interviewed Baby Doll.
Yeah.
Remember just the other day, I was asking about, did they think it was real? Or did not think it was real? And she said, back in the 80s, people kind of knew, but they didn't know. You know? Which, and because they were illustrating, this was also a very interesting, and it's something we've always kind of known. It was just articulated so well by this movie. In that I think it was Arn or Tully who were both interviewed. Arn had his WWE 2K15 shirt on, too, which is great. And they said that NWA, WCW NWA, was for the men who want to see
men.
Fights. Blue-collar men who want to see fights, whereas WWF was for little kids. I also thought it was interesting when they talked about Hogan and Flair and the potential of them going to WrestleMania together, and then, of course, it didn't happen. It was interesting that Hogan really seemed geeked out for the possibility and disappointed, and Flair, off the bat, said, no, I didn't care.
Yeah.
He said, you know, we had already kind of ruined it because we had fought like 10 times.
At the
house
show.
Yeah, I know. So, it's always interesting to get a read on... It's kind of like during the Scott Hall podcast with Stone Cold when he said, I wasn't, quote, a mark for the belts, for the gold. So it's always kind of interesting to get somebody's take on that. And then he says, you know, we did it. He said, I fought him later plenty of times in WCW.
Yeah.
And then what did Triple H say to counter that?
Oh, they were well past their prime.
If it was 10 years earlier, it would have been something else.
I'm going to touch on something real quick.
Yeah.
Kind of referencing something I talked about before. I always got the sense that despite Flair's obvious showmanship, his gravitas, that there were times, even early in his career, where his eyes betrayed a sense of sadness that was kind of lurking within him. And I think that only grew as he got older for various reasons. And obviously, after Reed's death, it'd make total sense.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this documentary did a decent job of kind of laying out why. I mean, we have tried to extrapolate why based on what they might have said in there. But ultimately, it was just the dichotomy within him of seemed like. Richard Flair and whatever baggage he had growing up versus the construction of Ric Flair.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of... that. I wish that they would have dived into that a little bit more. I'm not sure how much you really can. I mean, he seemed to be as straightforward as he could with every question that they threw at him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it did... You're right. That is a fascinating one. It was interesting when he was on the... Who was that? Sally Jesse Raphael?
Yeah. With her gym suit, track suit.
And people were talking about it being fake, and he kind of dodged the question a little bit. Because at the end of the day, you're kind of like, I'm not going to say a fake champion necessarily, because obviously we know that there was a reason that he was the world champion. And
there was metrics that he checked off, you know. If you're a boxing champ, because you just knocked the other person on the mat, or you score points with the judge, but...
Yeah.
Those are, you know, criteria all the same.
Yeah, but I mean, when you are living your life day to day as a mythical figure and not a real person, I mean, the Some of the stuff that cracked me up was Sting talking about when they're on the plane.
Oh, yeah, Shivani saying, so the story is apparently they're on a plane that's just full of wrestlers. That's what I gathered.
Yeah. they have these great little animated sections,
Flair disappears to the restroom and reemerges with his dress shoes, dress socks, and his robe.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes out, and then he opens his robe, and there's nothing underneath.
Yeah.
And according to Shivani, he is fully engorged.
That always cracked me because I always figured he'd be a phallicopter guy.
Yeah, I know.
But if you come out and you've got, like, your full strength, that's pretty brutal, man.
And then what Sting sort of said, I don't know the exact quote, but more or less, you know, like, I've never seen another wrestler's front area as much as I've seen Ric Flair.
He said, I think he said something like, I've never seen a man with his pants down as much as Ric Flair.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what it was. That was funny. The story also with it illustrates, man, how JR had it right when he said, it's all little pieces
story,
to the
right?
puzzle.
Yeah.
He says, you know, that it's what cracked me up was when Ric Flair sort of prefaced it by saying, you know, we'd roll into these little shit towns.
Well, you say Wichita.
Wichita
is not, I mean, it's compared to New York City, it's a small town, but Wichita for Kansas is a large city.
Well, yeah, I know, but who, you know, compared to, like, well, yeah, New York, obviously, but we don't know what, because, you know, you've heard about, like, the A team and the B team.
Yeah.
You know, if they're on an NWA WCW circuit and they go through, you know, an area outside of Wichita, for example.
Yeah.
It might not be as hustling and bustling, but for all we know, Wichita just didn't have a heavy nightlife.
Entirely true.
Back in the 80s, I mean, Charles Barkley used to clown Sacramento for its nightlife all the time, and San Antonio as well, I think. And so, you know, when you've gone through Chicago and some other places.
Atlanta and Miami.
Exactly, yeah. And
no, I understand that.
You come up to Wichita. And so, you know, JR said there was one night, you know, we'd go to a Holiday Inn, and there's literally, we go to the bar, and there's 10 people there, and he'd order 137 kamikazes.
Yep.
And he'd just start, like, he'd get the tray, and he'd start handing them out, and all the girls would love him. And he was like, why can't we just go to a place, order a couple of drinks, have some conversation, and call it a night? And he said, I just realized that it's because he craved companionship. You know, he always needed companionship.
Which might be another reason why he continued to get married.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So he always has somebody. I mean, it's... If you go out one night, let's say you go out on in one of these little crap towns that he's talking about, and you go to a bar, there's two people there, and you can't, and for one night you can't, at least internally you always know that back home, I've got something. I always have something back home, you know. So, it, you know, again, just really interesting stuff. That was the most interesting stuff there was. They talked to Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Yeah.
Flair
said that Steamboat was his favorite rival.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I like when they talked about the stuff that would happen during the match. Like he was saying, yeah, Steamboat would say, Flair would just give a little nod.
And he knew what it meant.
And he knew what it meant.
And someone else said that they never talked during the matches.
That's crazy.
Wrestling for an hour and not talking. Yeah. Not making obvious that they talked. They showed one shot where they were locked up, and both their arms were over their mouths. So they could have said something to each other.
Yeah.
But just the fact that the audience couldn't see them communicate.
Given the number of times they wrestled, apparently on the house show circuit, anyways, I would imagine after the first, I would speculate that after the first couple dozen, you wouldn't need to talk anymore.
Oh, I know.
You know?
I know.
So, you know, that's kind of interesting. They got into the Reed stuff, which was absolutely devastating. Now, you mentioned, I had mentioned the comment his daughter made about the Cabbage Patches. You said that something David said really brought you down.
Oh, just that he was never home.
Yeah.
You know, and then I don't remember if it was David or one of his other children said, you know, yeah, he would tell his kids, yeah, I'll be there for your basketball game, for example, and he wouldn't show.
And David said specifically, that's why I make sure my kids never have to do that. I'm always there for them.
Yeah.
You know, because I think the thing that really sort of, especially when they started talking about Reed, that really, like, dragged me down and made me kind of emotional was, you know, when they would show the footage of Reed as just, like, a little kid, and then Ric Flair, who's, like, Ric Flair, and he's being all daddy to him. And he really did seem to really love, I mean, you have to think, dude, to have the amount of success that Ric Flair has had for his passion, It's like they interviewed Michelle Beadle.
Mm-hmm.
And she said Ric Flair simply just had that it factor that you can't put your finger on. It's, we call it charisma, yes. Whatever you want to call it, natural
intangibles.
Charisma. Intangibles. And he had so much of it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It just, when they would go in close-up on him on the TV, you know, back in the day, especially when he's delivering promos, it's like, holy crap. Like, you feel it.
Yeah.
You know, you really feel it. You have to have, I honestly think there, part of that is just a ton of, and it's, again, it's intangible, but passion and heart. Like, I think that's a thing that could be, you know, maybe not scientifically measured, but it can be measured in, you know, in some degree.
Yeah, it turns out people react to you.
And so you see him with his kids, and there's, like, a palpable passion and love and energy there. And so to see the stuff with him and his kid, it's like, you know, as fathers ourselves, it, like, hits home exceptionally or especially hard because it's like, oh, my God, like, I couldn't imagine not being there for my kids. You know, I don't know how somebody can do that. And so when David Flair said that, it's like, oh, my God, yeah. But then they go into the Reed Flair stuff, and they interview Charlotte. And I think I knew, like, a little while ago that she had taken up the mantle. Like, I had known that Reed Flair was trying to take up the mantle, and then he died. And then Charlotte, I'd kind of heard along the way that she was going to kind of take up the mantle for him.
For Reed,
and
yeah.
That's a whole nother thing right there, because she has excelled so hardcore. Like, she has done so exceptionally well and exceeded anybody's expectations of her. She is such a natural.
Oh, yeah.
In the ring, on the mic, in the business, kind of interesting that somebody can succeed at that level while essentially carrying out somebody else's dream.
Yeah, I know.
And what that is inside of her, you know? Because it's like, if I'm carrying out somebody's dream, I imagine my passion's not going to be 100% with it. You know what I mean?
In terms of the actual activities, potentially, yeah.
But she's so damn good.
I know.
You know, like, she's transcendently good.
I know.
So I don't know. It's fascinating to me that somebody can do that.
Probably maybe the most heartbreaking quote from Flair regarding the Reed aspect of the documentary was when the director asked him, you know, if there's anything you could say to Reed.
Oh, yeah, I almost lost it then. Yeah.
And then he said, "Yeah, I say this every day," and he continues that he regrets being Reed's best friend rather than his father.
Yeah, yeah. Oof. Because he talked earlier about
there's one story about where he came home and then Reed was 16 or so and was drinking with his neighbor.
Yeah.
And it's like, why are you just cool with your kid drinking?
And he, like, laughs about it a little
bit. Yeah, and he said when Reed was 21 and he's wanted to hang out with the boys and he's 21.
You can't tell him no. Yeah, exactly. And then, but I mean, you know, you got to figure, I wonder if that's one of those things where it's like, there's a big difference between going and getting drunk with people and doing black tar heroin. Like, there's a gulf of difference there.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, for the right, you know, if you're wired in that way, then I guess it's not. And because that's ultimately what Reed died from, is an overdose from heroin. But that stuff was really, really, really heavy. I did appreciate when, so they talked about his retirement match with Shawn Michaels, of course,
yeah,
and how he said, and he mentions this in the book, that, you know, he absolutely hated the idea of retiring, and he said he woke up the next day. It's funny because in the book he describes it as, you know, the process of it happening was fantastic, even though he always had doubts in his mind. But then, you know, in the documentary and in the book, he mentioned, you know, he woke up the next day and he felt absolutely miserable.
He was sick, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, then he takes on the contract with TNA.
Well, his retirement in WWE was forced upon him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And JR said, well, you know, people love Ric Flair, but the government wants Richard Flair to pay his taxes, you know, and he needed the money. But I think there's a... It wasn't just that he needed the money. I think the guy just loved the spotlight. I think he loved being Ric Flair.
Yeah,
because if you retire that, then you're essentially dead if that's what you've been living for all that time.
Yeah, if you define yourself by Ric Flair the performer, then yeah, if that performer retires, then yeah, you have to come face-to-face with being Richard Flair.
Yeah.
But the way they treated his tenure in TNA was as if it was probably the worst embarrassment possible.
Like, they act like he did porn or something. That's what I tweeted out. Of the,
yeah,
you know?
They showed the cage match and it was James Storm that pulled his pants down. Mm-hmm, so
yeah.
His buttocks were exposed.
Well, they showed James Storm breaking the glass over his head and the beer bottle over his head.
Yeah.
And you know, he was bleeding and stuff. They showed a bunch of the thing that he would do when he would just start knocking his own head and blood would start coming down.
Yeah.
And they made it out as if that was
the lowest of the low.
Exactly. But, I mean, there was some good stuff to be had there, you know? And he was still, even at that time, he was still Ric Flair.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't like it was, you know, I mean, they make it, they act like it's, what's his face? Who's the porno guy that they based Dirk Diggler off of?
Oh, John Holmes.
John Holmes. In his later days, he was doing some gay porn. And that was, you know, to him, a low point because he couldn't get work doing the other stuff. And they made it seem like it was that. It's like, come on, it was just, like, he was still the legend. He was still Ric Flair. He was still the man and everything. And a lot of people on Twitter, since I mentioned that, have pointed out, yeah, no, there was this part, there was this, and he did some good stuff. Like, they reformed basically the Four Horsemen as Fortune.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, with some of the top names there. So, I don't know. I thought that was kind of silly. It's not like he was, you know, going to high school gymnasiums and killing himself. I mean, honestly, like...
Well, that spot, they showed a bit of a match between him and Foley where he got back dropped on the thumbtacks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, just... Someone who's 60 years old shouldn't be doing that, probably, but...
But it's Ric Flair, and he was, you know, I would imagine that... Because he was commanding a lot of money doing that, too. I mean, TNA was paying him big money. And, you know, honestly, when I think of what they were going for, I actually kind of think of Terry Funk. I think of a guy who cannot let go.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, you need to stop now.
Yeah. Before, you know, something really seriously bad happens.
Because he'll do any old thing. Ric Flair was still commanding a lot of money doing what he was doing, and he was still Ric Flair. So, that stuff was kind of interesting. I'm trying to think of other high or low points for me.
Well, I think we covered the basic story arc pretty thoroughly.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I kind of also feel that this thing, there could be a director's cut of this. It's like three hours long.
I know. There's two interview sessions, the director said, before the movie proper started.
Mm-hmm.
18 months apart, I want to say.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I think it was in 2015, October 2015, and then February of this year.
Oh, wow.
It's a matter of months before.
Yeah.
He, you know, had his health scare.
Yeah. Triple H had a lot of interesting things to say. I mean, the most devastating thing, of course, was when he was talking about when Reed was trying to work with the WWE, and they tested him, and his test came up positive for stuff.
Or the constant liar quote.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then he said, hey, Rick, this came up. And he's like, oh, that can't be. And he's like, well, it's here.
The test doesn't lie, essentially.
The test doesn't lie.
And Flair would say, well, I asked Reed, and he said, no, it's not true.
Yeah, and then Triple H said, okay, we can test him again because it's you, and I'm telling you now that we're going to test him so he knows that he's going to be tested, and then it comes back even worse than the first one. And he even said he punctuated, and this is again one of the more interesting bits and sort of sums everything up. He says, Flair, in a lot of ways, I use it as an example of what not to do in the business to young and upcoming talent because you risk losing yourself in the end and putting yourself, I think he said, in a precarious situation, essentially. Mm-hmm. Because as we all know, he's always had money problems because his philosophy has always been, if you make money, you spend money.
Well, because he wanted to live the lifestyle of Ric Flair, of the character. So, there, I mean, earlier in the movie, he talked about when he first started making really good money, one of the first things he bought was a limousine.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I've never even, I've never ever thought, hey, you know, if I make it big, I really want to buy a limousine.
Yeah.
Like, you rent a limousine, at, you know, for special occasions.
Yeah, I know. Like, would he have someone drive him around the country in a limousine?
Right, I know, exactly.
I know.
I need to go to Target. I need my, where's my driver?
There was one story where the director asked him, you know, are you surprised you're still alive at this point? And he said, yeah. He said something like, did he say he went back and forth to Japan twice in 3 days? or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
That he was drinking the whole time.
The story with him and the psychiatrist.
Oh, that was
really, really good. It was really interesting. So yeah, it's probably going to be running ad nauseum on ESPN.
Oh yeah, and usually if you have cable service with on demand stuff, it's usually ESPN's pretty good about putting their 30 for 30s up pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and it should make its way to Netflix at some point. A lot of 30 for 30s are on there too.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. So definitely
check
it out.
Your local cable provider.
Yeah.
For future airings.
This is not an advertisement for the show.
It's no.
It's really interesting.
That's just more public service on my part.
We recommend it.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, that's it for now. Thanks for watching. Until next time, we'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now, all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing to the weird to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.